an interview with Ethel Allen on December 16th, 1982. Dorothy Collins and myself, I'm Laura Smale, are doing the interview, and we're doing it in your house. That's just too...
To begin with, and I think to sort of set the stage, Mrs. Smale, would you give us a little bit of your background, where you were born and when and what kind of a family you lived in, this kind of thing, so that we can see where you started?
All right. Well, I started in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on July 13th, 1906, which is close to 77 years ago, and I took my bachelor's degree at the university, starting out with the idea of getting a degree in botany. And when I did accomplish that in 1928, the Depression was on us and there were no jobs available, so I went back and got a master's degree in bacteriology under Dr. Fred, who later became president of the university. My husband, in the meantime, had his two degrees from University of Texas and came up here in about 1927, I would say, to get his doctorate in bacteriology under Dr. Baldwin. And he was a, what they call a TA now, teaching assistant, laboratory assistant. And immediately after we both graduated in 1930, and he got a job to teach at the University of Hawaii, we left and proceeded out to Honolulu to take that job.
What was the degree you came back for?
I came for master's. Master's.
Master's.
Master's of Science, I guess you'd call it. Mm-hmm. And so we had 15 years in Honolulu together. And he mostly as a teacher, he also was interested in botany, as that was my main interest, really. And the combination of botany and bacteriology was accomplished professionally in this symbiotic association between leguminous plants and this particular group of organisms that are able to fix nitrogen from the air into the plant by way of root nodules.
All right, before you get
you
that
cut
far
me off
ahead,
whenever you,
yes.
Yeah.
What kind of family did
oh,
you
of
grow
course.
Up in?
Yes, I grew up in, my mother was second generation Dutch, and my father was second generation German. And
to what degree was your family educated? Was it unusual for someone from your family, particularly a woman, to go to the university?
Well, I think that was conditioned by the fact that my sister was had 10% sight. She was legally blind, so she did not go on. But my father saw to it that she got in a musical education. She had a beautiful voice, and she was operatic quality, but because she had no stage presence, she couldn't make it in that direction. My brother got a master's degree in chemistry, and because my father was in the business of oil, he was trained in oil chemistry. None of the other cousins, so forth, had college experience. But I knew from the beginning that I was going to be a biologist. You know, this is.
Do you remember what got you interested in science?
Oh, yeah, a wonderful biology teacher in high school.
Always works out.
Where did you go to high school?
West Division High School in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee.
Yes.
How did your family react to your going to Hawaii? And how did you feel about going from the great Midwest?
Oh, well, it's whither thou goest, I will go. There was no question about it. My husband and I had a tremendous symbiotic, we were like twins, you know, that nothing would have interfered with my going, even though my dear mother was heartbroken, you know, really, naturally. This was the great unknown in those days. And in those days, it took 8 to 10 days to get there by boat. There were no airplanes. So it was difficult for them, yes. But for me, it was there was no choice.
Were you excited about it? Going that far away?
I don't know. I really... It was just we were going. That was it. Sure, I suppose so.
And what did you do in Hawaii? What, your husband was at the university?
Mm-hmm.
And what? And were you there as well? Or were you...
No, I had... Because our interests were absolutely parallel and intertwined more than parallel, I worked with him with no pay. I hardly ever received any any pay for what I did.
This was
understood, you see, and wives didn't work in the same departments with their husbands in those days. In fact, wives seldom worked.
Yes, this is quite common. Was there, in Hawaii, was there a rule against this, or was it just sort of taken for granted that this is, was?
I'm not so sure. I've had a different understanding of wifehood, I think. My idea was that the men earned the living, and the wives helped them as best they could in entertaining and in being agreeably sociable with the rest of the people in the... It was a small college. It was a small university at that time. Whereas University of Wisconsin was about 8,000 to 9,000 student population. Mm-hmm. The University of Hawaii was, I think, about between 2 and 3. And we were one big family, and every one of us was foreign. We were all away.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hung together, as it were, we made our own social life. And it was a wonderful place to be in those days. It was very Oriental. It was 80% Oriental. And we were a long way from home. It took the mail 2 weeks to get to us. And so we did, you know. We had very, very close friendships, and it was just a delightful situation to learn how to grow up and get matured, I think. It was...
Did you have any a family out there?
No, we've never had children.
You felt then that you both were doing what you was a labor of love, working
yes.
with your husband
oh,
in
yes.
the laboratory.
Oh, yes.
But you also felt that you were had social obligations
yeah.
for as a
yeah,
non-working wife.
This was the way to be a husband and wife, was to be a helpmeet in the home and a helpmeet in the... For me, it was because I was trained in this direction. This was my great love, to just carry on. And
mm-hmm.
been a waste of training, in my book, if we hadn't done it.
When did you come back here, and did you come directly to Madison when you came back to the United States, or did,
no.
did you move? What brought you back?
We came back once for about a week and then went on to Europe for 15 months and studied in European laboratories and continued our project in botanical gardens in Europe
mm-hmm.
and made that kind of contact. And then we went back to Honolulu, that would be in 1937, and then for 3 successive summers, my husband was invited to take the head of the department's place at the University of Texas, because that's where he got his degrees from, University of Texas.
Was this at Austin?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. It was in 37, 38, or 38, 39, and 40, just for the summers. So I've never seen Austin when it was anything but hot. And so, let's see. Where do we go from here? Then the European War broke out, of course, in 19... Am we running out of time or something?
No, I'm just trying to... I couldn't see it from the way the light yeah. was. But go
in,
on.
In 39, the European War broke out, and we went back. You know, we had been at Austin for the summer
mm-hmm.
and went back. And then we were there for the outbreak of Pearl Harbor.
Were you in...
In Honolulu, yes.
In Honolulu,
yes, we saw,
mm-hmm.
the thing happening and experienced it. In fact, right now I'm getting ready to make a duplicate of a war diary that is 2 volumes for the archives.
Of yours?
Yes.
It's oh, our, fascinating.
Our, that should yes. be wonderful. It's full of news clippings, and mostly it is rumor stories. It's, Home Little was a rumor mill.
I'm sure.
At the beginning of the war. We just, horrible rumors developing all around. My husband went then. The university was closed immediately and stayed closed for about 3 months. And our laboratory was turned into a water bacteriological laboratory. But first I want to backtrack, because the reason I think that we found Honolulu so, Hawaii rather, the islands, so fascinating was because there was this vast wealth of leguminous plants, which is our field of work. I think one can safely say that nearly 50% of the trees present were leguminous trees. And this is the bean, pea, alfalfa, clover family in temperate zones. But in the tropics, it takes the form of enormous trees that are blooming trees. And they bloom with flowers first, as a rule, so that you will have an entirely red display of flowers, or an entirely yellow, or entirely pink, the so-called shower trees. Beautiful. It is. It's a fascinating family. And as one goes into the tropics proper, then you get into the timber trees, the Philippine mahogany, and the rosewoods, the very valuable timber trees, which are now being eliminated. You know, this is a... This is where Hugh Ildis gets excited.
I suddenly realized.
Then, of course, that kind of plant exploration and hunt for the organisms, hunt for the nodules on the root system, so that we could isolate the organisms and find out what makes them tick. You see, you have to get a pure culture of the organism to mix with a seed in order to get this symbiotic association.
I'd like to know how you work together. That is, you went into the laboratory every day, and
not every day. That's the reason I didn't really want a job. Because I could if I had to be at a tea party, or if I had to do some social work or something like this, I was completely free of obligations monetarily. But if we had a run of isolating these organisms, or if we had to go into the field to get them in the first place, then I was completely free to do that. See?
And were you preparing the cultures, or I don't suppose that's what you're doing?
Yes, a little of everything, sure. Helping in plant identification and in isolating the organisms and preparing and making sure that they have to be kept alive and they have to be fed. We feed them on an agar plate, which is like Jell-O. It has a sugar in it and has protein source and has vitamins and this sort of thing. And then they grow, and by growing, they grow in enormous numbers by the millions, so that they finally become visible. From microscopic thing into a big colony that is visible. And then you take from that and you put it onto fresh medium and keep it alive for years and years and years, forever, if need be. But they do need to be tended, as it were.
So he had to be responsible all the time for them.
Yes, that actually ended up by being my responsibility, because he was teaching and
So you did have to go in.
You could take
an afternoon or two off.
Weeks off, really. I mean, because we traveled a lot. And then these things do, you can put them in the refrigerator, and they hold for 3 to 4 to 5 months, because it's not a demanding organism, for instance, as a pneumonia organism would be. That you would have to keep in cultivation every several days, or it would die off on you.
During this period of research, were you publishing results?
Oh, yes.
When
always jointly.
It was always a
always
joint paper.
Jointly.
With your name, no question.
With my name on it, sometimes first, sometimes second, depending on who had carried the load. Yes.
But there was no question of that.
No question whatsoever.
It was essentially then a research team.
Exactly.
It was a research you weren't team. Really, and you did you ever feel as if you were more an assistant than a...
Oh, or never, a, never. Very completely symbiotic. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful relationship. A most unusual relationship.
It sounds like you must have felt that you were lucky compared to...
Oh, yes.
That not every woman who was a student in the same field that her husband was would be able to get along that well working.
Well, I think that's true. He was completely unselfish. And I suppose I was too, because I never demanded any salary or I never demanded first place. But he'd say, you know, you did most work on this. This time we'll put your name first. You know, this kind of thing. And between the two of us, we published... I don't know, some 35, 40 papers together, and some chapters and some books together. And whenever he was asked to give a lecture before a group of a society, there was no question but what I was to come along. And, you know, we were very compatible socially and professionally.
What took place then once there was the war situation and the university was closed?
Oh, yes.
Did your husband have to go into the service or did he stay out?
No, he was considered essential. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they could have stood another soldier over there.
I can imagine, or sailor.
Oh, the island was about to sink for all the military that was over there. He was concerned. He thought we were really quite convinced that we were expendable. And he was convinced that I should leave. And I wasn't at all convinced of that. I think more families broke up because of just absence. For instance, it would be very hard for a lone man to exist. Who was going to do the grocery shopping when you had complete, total blackout at sunset? And I mean, it was just no go. I saw more families break up because the wife, she took the children to the mainland. It was just not a good deal at all. And
well, there was an atmosphere then in Hawaii of fear of attack and
oh yes, mm-hmm. yes, and grave shortages. Immediately, there was no sale of liquor. The stores were closed for a day in order to get their wits about them, what they could supply us with. And then I think the maximum purchase was maybe $10, which would amount to maybe $20 now. And absolute total blackout. That is the interesting thing about the diary is what people did to blackout. What could you do when you're living on hillsides and you were surrounded by an ocean and there were submarines out there that would reflect moonlight against glass? Mm-hmm. You know, this was really something people would think there were signals that were being flashed, but they weren't. It was just moonlight. A tree waving, this kind of thing. Well, first of all, what we did, the laboratory was turned into a water analysis station because the Army was in great need of opening up areas for men to bivouac in tent colonies, this sort of thing. And they had to hook it up with running water. And the only flat areas would be farmlands that belonged to Chinese and Japanese. And those farmlands took place of rice and taro, which is a water-growing plant, and maybe little vegetable patches. And the fertilizer of choice to the Oriental is always what's called night soil, which is human feces. And so the soil was contaminated, as you may well imagine, with enteric organisms. And so when the Army came along and laid the pipes, the boys would just put the pipes off the truck and just dump them on this soil, and they would get, the pipes inside would get contaminated. So what needed to be done then was, once they were all hooked up, was to flush them out thoroughly with water. Just flush, flush, flush. And what we did then, the Army would bring us the water samples until we were sure that in the laboratory they were completely free of any organisms that were related to typhoid or enteric human intestinal organisms. See, well, eventually, and not too long after, the Army was in complete control and didn't need that kind of work anymore, you see. So then, and this was all free. You know, we didn't get paid for doing this.
Who
just
was paying? How would you, how are you getting
the
your
Army
money?
Well, the Army would be. I mean, I had a big badge that meant I could walk through areas, and I had my picture on it. And it was called a U.S. Army, what did they call it, Engineering Corps. Well, the Army paid the stenographers handsomely. Oh, yes, they had gobs of money for
but not you.
But I didn't ask for it. I mean, this was your war duty. You wanted, when disaster hits, you want to be useful. You want to be busy. And, you know, what's the difference?
But
what
your
is
husband
money?
Must have had a source of income then.
Well, I suppose so. I don't remember ever seeing any Army checks or anything like that. I really don't. I don't. That angle.
But the university opened up again.
Oh, not for until the following March or May or April.
Yeah.
And I think we had some money from the university because we were under contract. But I don't remember that angle of it at all. I really don't.
Did your husband take care of all of the family business arrangements,
no,
paying bills and this
usually,
kind of thing?
No, I usually did. I enjoyed that kind of thing. And there wasn't too much to take care of. We were renting a house. We were very limited to maybe 10 gallons of gasoline a month or something like that. There wasn't, you know, at night, you just didn't do anything. We didn't have TV. We didn't have radio. We read. We read like mad. We read everything we could get our hands
behind
on
the
from
blackout.
The library. Yes, we had a room in the house that was built into the hill. We were on about the highest street in that valley in Honolulu, and the house was two-story. There were people living above us. We were renting, and they were renting, and this house was built into the hill, so that one room, what had no windows on one side, had one little window. And then it had no exposure to the ocean on the other side. So we were very happy in there. And we had lots of newspapers at first on that window. And then finally I was able to buy black denim. And we made a black denim curtain. And I think that house, that room was never ventilated. It was just too inconvenient to open windows, you see. And many people painted, to their regret later, painted their windows black. And in the diary, I have an ad that the paint companies, the hardware companies, were renting paintbrushes because they ran out of paintbrushes. So they would rent you a paintbrush for a day or two at a price. It was, and of course, we were not permitted to drive our cars. And those who did put black paint on their headlights, so that if by any chance they made a mistake and turned their lights on, it wouldn't show. It was war. It was living in a war zone. It's very interesting, and quite frightening. And then very boring because nothing happened really.
When did you come to the University of Wisconsin?
In 1920.
No, I mean afterwards.
Oh, afterward.
Yes.
He was offered a job after Midway, you know, when the war was beginning to show that we may not be in complete command, but at least they weren't going to come back this way. Then he was offered a job at the University of Maryland. And he went there, and I went to my folks in Milwaukee. My father was very senile and very ill. My mother had died in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Milwaukee until it became feasible for us to be able to live together, which was a matter of about 6 months. And the University of Maryland was a mistake, really. It was a second-class university as far as he was concerned. And I went, well, I spent several weekends going back and forth, sitting, you know, and during the war, you sat up in these horribly dirty trains. Mm. And I'd go back and forth and see if I could find a place to live, and there was nothing. I remember once I just sat on a curb and cried. You know, I was so frustrated. We just, it was, life was tough.
This was in the 40s?
This was 40, be 42. Mm-hmm. Because the attack was 41. And we stayed on, I can't remember now. I have it somewhere there. I think we stayed on all of 42, and I think this must have been 43, that he was made this offer, and we came back.
Oh, but and then when did you actually come
then
here?
We came the end of 43.
To Wisconsin?
Yes. And then we couldn't find a place to live together either,
who,
you see.
Who invited you?
It was the bacteriology department, yes. Mm-hmm. Through Dr. Fred, I'm quite sure. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted to rebuild that area. They wanted to rebuild the symbiotic. Because Wisconsin was the forerunner in the nation, was the foremost department in this field of study. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to keep it that way. It had run down. They'd lost people. Is that light bothering you?
No.
No.
Because I would
like
to draw the curtain.
Had they lost many people during the war? Was the department...
Well, it was kind of lack of interest. You know, there was a time when it was felt that everything that was known or needed to be known was known. And it was just not going forward. The younger people didn't see the need for this particular phase of study. And there was a great wave toward the end of the 40s in away from practical bacteriology. You know, appliable bacteriology. The young people then poo-pooed this. It was all electron microscope and highfalutin enzymology and all this stuff. And this was agricultural application that was considered kind of old-fashioned and farmerish. You know, kids, they want to come to a farm, a cow college. You know what I'm speaking
of?
Yes,
I do, but that kind of research was going on here too, wasn't it? I mean, the
sure
the,
it was. It was an attitude.
The pure
science, yes. But see, Dr. Fred was moved up to president. Dr. Baldwin was moved up to vice president. Elizabeth McCoy, did you ever interview her?
No,
do you know?
That's one of the great failings. Yes, maybe you can. Say something about her, because I don't think anybody's talked about her on tape. What do you know about Elizabeth
McCoy? I know
McCoy?
What she did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm familiar with her work,
yes.
But I'd like to hear more about it. She had been here a number of years before you arrived.
Elizabeth was in Europe when I was in the department. When I came, as I wasn't in the department, I was on a $60 a month fellowship. You know, isn't it? You couldn't live on that night. Well, it's $30 for your room and board and $30 for your food. You did covered it all right.
Yeah. This was went for your MA.
For my MA, yes.
MS, I suppose.
And Elizabeth was in Europe at the time, so I'd hear about the great Elizabeth, but I never got to meet her until we came back. And then the joke of it all was that I lived with her for about 3 months while we were hunting. We bought this house when we came back, but we couldn't live in it. We had to evict
this house.
We had to evict the people from it because, see, there was such a housing shortage. Mm-hmm. And the people, when we bought, knew that they were going to be evicted. We felt very badly about it, but after all, we had to live too. So Elizabeth, she was a very, very generous, kind-hearted woman. And she said, my mother just died, and I've got this apartment. I'm living alone. Would you come live with me? But not my husband, just she and I. There wasn't room. It was a very mm-hmm. small one-bedroom apartment. So I reluctantly did because I didn't feel it was right. But it was a case of living in Milwaukee. And this way, it was a transition for me because then I could work in the department, not in any paid position, but I could help my husband, as everybody in the apartment would be saying, are you here helping your husband?
Well, by that time, that must have been pretty unusual to have people coming into the lab and not being part of the paid staff.
That's right, too. And I wasn't helping my husband. Heck, I was helping myself. You know, I was with him, and we could have lunches together, and we didn't have any home life together. But at least it was better than transporting myself back and forth to Milwaukee, and I didn't care that much about living at home either.
Where was he living at the time?
At the club, University Club.
At the University mm-hmm. Club.
Do they still have people living there?
I don't think so.
I don't think they do either. He lived there while we were courting, as it were. I lived at the place that was all torn down in Sterling Court.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And he had lived at the University Club for all 3 years of his graduate work. Loved it. Had a great feeling that a University Club was an essential part of a university. It was very, very grossly sorrowed at the way that club changed. Really, you know, when they, mm-hmm. well, they have haul-in meals now from the union,
mm-hmm.
don't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think women can go through the front door now.
I'm curious as to how, did you go into the university club?
Always went through the side door.
Did you eat with the women in there sometimes?
Well, I ate with him.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
You could eat
Yes,
with him,
we could
you?
Eat together. Uh-huh. At noon, I don't know if they served evening meals or not. But anyway, that was getting back to Elizabeth. Were we talking?
Yes,
Elizabeth. She was Dr. Fred's right hand man. She was a farm girl, and her family owned two farms that I know of, right across the street from each other, and they were milk farms. Elizabeth had a brother who had no interest whatsoever in the farm. And she loved to keep the books. She loved to keep the records on the milk production for individual cows. She liked to keep the accounts on what they obtained from the slaughterhouse for the meat of the animals, the chickens, the whole business. She should have been a man. She ran that farm most efficiently, and Dr. Fred admired her tremendously for him, because essentially Dr. Fred was a farm man too, and he had tremendous admiration for her. And I don't think Dr. Fred could have negotiated the way he did if she hadn't just really looked after the details.
That's interesting. Or do you mean even further, when he was dean? And
that I wouldn't know. I think not. I think he had very efficient office help. But he sought out her advice a lot. And I know that she made almost daily trips to the home. And they would sit around and talk about production and farm and university policy and this sort of thing. She was very good. And she had lots of good graduate students, too. Mm-hmm. And she was good at publishing. It wasn't a case of being just theoretical. She saw the application of things and carried them out at meetings. She got good students. She recognized ability in students and negotiated to keep them on in fellowships and in grants and this sort of thing. She was generous too. She was generous with her time and generous with her money and her friendship.
You became friends?
Oh, yes, we were very good friends because I lived with her.
And you went on being friends after you...
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What did she ever comment on your... did she ever say, Ethel, you ought to be getting a job yourself, or you ought to be getting a PhD?
Dr. Fred did, but she didn't.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he mean it?
Oh, yes. I think he was grossly disappointed that I got married.
Huh.
He told me I was making a great mistake. Mm-hmm. Dr. Fred gave me about 5 bad pieces of advice, and that was one of them.
Well, you didn't follow that one.
No,
so
I didn't.
All right.
No. I didn't follow any of his bad.
The other pieces.
One, he absolutely objected to our buying this house. It was completely foolish. The market was too high, and this was too far away from the laboratory. And I took a job in California while I was doing graduate work. And he talked to me. He made me come to his home, and he talked to me for about... Oh, I think I spent 3 hours there. Don't take the job. It's a waste of your time. It's out of your field. And it was just, and I just said, I'm going to take that job. I'm already committed. I want that job. And I just bucked him all the way, and he was quite angry with me. And the other thing was when we came back, he wanted us to live in their house. Wanted to live in that.
With them.
With them.
Oh.
I said, absolutely not. You know, this is something we can't countenance.
Mm.
And so, I mean, these were the things where he was, I think, selfish in that when he had something that he wanted you to go in that direction and I would not be pushed or led or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But we were great friends.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did he feel this way about all of his students that he considered to be very good students? Did he have this
Dr. Fred had to have his way.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He often did not have good ideas, in my opinion. But by golly, that's the way it was going to be. He was set.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was not used to being bucked at home, perhaps. Or...
Mm-hmm.
He was a very fortunate man. He had people advising him wisely on the Hill. And he had very staunch help. I don't think he could have operated without Dr. Baldwin.
I was going to ask you how much of a prep.
I don't think he could have operated. He had, one of my friends described him perfectly. He said he had a grasshopper mind. And he did. If you ever went up to his office, he was distracting you completely about his local little interests. The wood in this desk came from so-and-so. See that picture over there? That came from. So he was always jumping around. And then he would be jumping onto some pet project or something like that. But he had people around him who stabilized him and who brought him back on track.
I know there are people who say that what happened was that you went to see Dr. Fred and then you went down to Dr. Baldwin to find out what actually was
going on. Exactly. he had charm. He had tremendous charm. That southern graciousness, that soft voice, and that ability to always remember your name. He would call people by name whom he hadn't seen for years, and who were nobodies.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come out, they were so flattered and so pleased. You know, this is an art, a gift, perhaps. A gift, I think.
Yeah.
Mrs. Fred was the same way. Mrs. Fred, she made a study of this when she went in. She memorized, she had lists of names. She kept who belonged to what, why this person should be recognized. I admire her for that.
To revert back.
Yeah, we got lost on that.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. This is why we're doing this project, is to get this kind of thing that would be lost if we didn't talk to people. But we go back to the era when you first came here and you were living with Elizabeth McCoy and working in the laboratory.
That was after we came back.
That was after we came back here.
In the 45. After we'd been to Maryland and then came back.
And
maybe
came
46,
back.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's 46. Yes, 46. Going on 47, yes.
So what was the university like?
Would you like to know what it was like in 1930?
Yes. You know, from a size standpoint, how did you feel about it? You were a student at that time.
I was a student, and I was not a student. I was having lots of fun. This was the first time away from home, and it was in 1924 on to 30. It was a very social school. We wore hats to class and gloves and high-heeled shoes and, you know, this whole bit. It was, you went to college to be seen and have fun. I was a very poor student, actually, except in biology, which I loved dearly. And then when I couldn't get, and I took, my father said, you have got to take a teaching certificate, get that, because you have to have some insurance of a job. And that was a very good thing, except I'll tell you later about that. I got the teaching certificate, hated every minute of those dumb ed courses, but I couldn't get a job because we had the Depression. And I was very short and very immature looking, and I was told on interviews, well, you could never control a class. Mm. You know, so that is the reason then I went back and got a master's, and Dr. Fred was responsible for seeing that I had a fellowship in the field, in his field, you see. So I didn't make use of that teaching certificate until during the war, which was, 15 years later. And then it came in very handy, because in this war period, I taught some. I worked in a blood bank, and that was interesting, because that was the only blood bank in a United States war zone, an American blood bank, you see. And we processed blood to send out on ships, and we processed blood for the wounded that came to the hospitals. That was a good experience.
And this was in Hawaii?
In Hawaii, in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. And I got it because I was a bacteriologist. I had proof that the blood was pure, you see.
And where did you teach?
I taught in Honolulu in an academy. That was an interesting school because that was the only academy of boarding school in the United States west of the Rockies. It was begun in the end of the 1800s. And the missionary families who lived in Honolulu, you see, sent their kids here to boarding school rather than sending them east to Princeton and Yale and the big five women's schools. And it was college preparatory. It was a very, very excellent school. And it's still operating. It's a very high-class school called Punahou.
Say that again.
Punahou. P-U-N-A-H-O-U.
So, I don't know that you got back into your student days. Did you live in a sorority?
I was an anti-sorority girl.
Why?
I don't like being molded with a group of people who are of like mind. I'm not a joiner. I don't join clubs.
So where did you live then?
I lived in Barnard Hall for 3 years. And that was wonderful because it was right on campus, you know, Lathrop Hall with the gym right next door and got the back door to the hill. And then I lived in a rooming house somewhere off of Langdon, and then I lived across from the stadium in an apartment house when I was a graduate student. Yeah.
Did you? You didn't have to work.
No, I did not. I was.
Your father was an oil guy.
Yes. Well, it wasn't that big then, but it was.
So you just had a good time. Did you go, were you in student activities at all?
Swimming. But outside of that, no.
You were having dates and...
Oh, yeah. The usual stuff that kids do, and I don't know any better. And I think that's important. It is important, I think.
But that went on outside of sororities and fraternities,
too. Oh, yes, entirely, yes. I think partly my brother was a fraternity man, and he hated it. And so he didn't influence me, but he afterward, when I didn't join, he complimented me. And then he said, I'll tell you, no, I just hate my fraternity brothers. I just hate the fraternity. I hate the whole bit.
That would have been influential.
Yes, it would have been. But he was smart enough to not to tell me.
Did you know Dorothy Naplund or Emily Hahn? They must have been there about the same time.
No, I don't. I think they're a little younger than I. Emily Hahn's books I know, but I never knew her.
Just wondering if your life as a student mixed up with theirs.
No, it didn't.
And what were the best the classes you most enjoyed?
Well, I hated history.
This is a little outside of faculty wife,
yeah,
but
I think it's important.
Well, anything that had to do with biology was my dish.
So you the history and English and...
Oh, I hated history, and I was very poor. My father thought I should take econ, and I damn near flunked it, you know. I nearly flunked. Ancient history, and you had no choice. I mean, why I had to go on ancient history, which was
didn't like
too bad. Now I would love it. But I was...
Needle is waving back and forth.
All right, fine. Well, we are recording.
All right.
So, you are recording. Now, you were talking about...
Let's see, you're a professor you had. Was that what you were going to say?
I think I was going to follow through on why I disliked ancient history, because this was my first exposure to lecturers who had terrific, thick foreign accents, and we just couldn't understand that man. He was, you know, he was a world authority, and he was a Russian Vasiliev.
Was it?
And Rostovsky, yes.
And you couldn't understand him?
Oh, what do you know?
Oh, dear.
It was, now I know how big he is and how what a reputation, but then he was just a foreign guy who was ununderstandable. This is awful. Kids shouldn't go to college so young. They should go out in the world for a while and learn what's important and then go back.
I kind of agree.
You agree, don't you? You know, it's like love. It's wasted on the young or whatever.
Well, there seems to be, at the moment, somewhat of a trend to do that kind of thing.
Yes, I think it's good.
Do you think that's helpful?
Yes, I do.
Well, as a young Milwaukee woman, you went from Madison, which had 8,000 students, to this small university in Hawaii, and then you came back here. And
then
what
we
was
went
your,
to Maryland.
Maryland, and
but that was the war was not over, and it was a horrible place to be, because it was such a small town, College Park. There was no place to eat on Sundays. And we had to go to Washington every Sunday by bus to eat. We couldn't get breakfast. We couldn't get anything. I understand it's greatly changed now. That's just a whole series of... We had to live with people who had children, share the bath with the kids. Yeah. You know, it was war.
You were going to ask the comparison between...
Yes,
when
you came back... The university had it grown. This was during when you came back here. Mm-hmm. The war was still on, so there was some feeling of that. What was the campus like at that time?
The campus was, as I remember, I think that the Freds refused to live in the house that is left for the president. What is the name of that house up on the hill, up on Prospect Avenue? It has a name. Anyway, the Freds didn't live there because they thought that the wax and the waves should live there. And so they hung on to their little house. You knew that, didn't you?
I didn't know that was the reason.
Yes, that was the reason.
That was why they stayed
down.
They were
down
living
in the house that is Henry House.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because Dr. Fred really and truly, you know, he loved that this was pretty stylish to go up in that great big house on the hill. And he and Mrs. Fred loved that other house. And so they turned that over to the girls as a dormitory for a while. And then they did move up there. And that was, I think, another reason was Mrs. Fred, she was a social person. She liked people. She was very outgoing and warm. But I don't think she liked to be responsible for big parties. And so she didn't. If she didn't live in that big house, she didn't have to give.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it like? How many students were there?
Here?
By then. Were there more students than there had been when you were here as a student?
Yes, sure. Because all that dormitory building had taken place in the meantime. And students, since the war was now becoming over, were attracted back to college. And there were a lot of people in uniform even then. But that was the era of building those so-called temporary huts to house the war students, you know, those eyesores. As Dr. Fred used to say, there's nothing so temporary. There is nothing so permanent as a temporary hut. It was a long time before they came down.
Where were they?
Well, there was, for instance, here's the bacteriology building right at that corner between that and Ag Hall, right in front of the home ec building. They were just scattered wherever there was.
Now, this was this for housing or for teaching?
This was for teaching. Uh-huh, these were temporary. That's where the ROTC units were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know what they did about the housing. I think they were in the dormitories. Am I right? Do you know about this?
No,
I'm
not
sure. I'm not sure on that. Of course, there was a downswing in student population at that time.
Well, I think that housing went up after the war when the veterans were coming back.
Yes, yes.
And that would be the 49 and around 50.
Uh-huh.
And then it went way up, and then it went down a bit, and then it started up again.
That's true.
As part of what was the social life like during that period? When was there any?
Frankly, I don't remember. I don't know what the social life was like.
As a faculty wife, were you still expected to entertain? Do you recall that?
We did quite a bit of entertaining of students then. And had them for Thanksgiving dinners and had them for Christmas parties. But, and of course, the League was operating, and the Ag College women, what do they call themselves?
Daughters
of Demeter.
Demeter, yes.
Mm-hmm. They would have Christmas teas.
Did you go to those?
I'm not that kind of a person. I went once in a while, but very...
Was it because you felt yourself a scholar?
I just don't like that kind of thing. No, I don't consider myself a scholar. Being around people talking chit-chat like that isn't my idea of a good time.
Mm.
I'd rather go out and walk.
What was the reaction of the other women in the the wives in the department to your lack of interest in those things?
I think they always said, "Well, she's helping her husband." You know, I think that's it. Well, she was,
and they understood that perfectly well.
Sure, and they were having young children, and
uh-huh.
and I was older than most of them were. Elizabeth McCoy and I were the two older people in the group. Elizabeth used to come over quite frequently. She'd bring us farm produce. She'd bring a chicken or a duck or fresh eggs or something like that and have dinner with us.
What about faculty women? Did you get to know any of them? Women, Ruth Glasso or see what?
Well, I belonged to Sigma Delta Epsilon, which was the scientific fraternity. And that is Ruth Glasso and Elizabeth and the Dick, Helen, and what is the one who's in the medical school? Ruth, Dickie.
Uh-huh.
And
that's an elected membership, is it? I mean, a nomination?
That is an honorary thing, yeah. It's a society.
And
in which they would give papers on what their work was about.
When were you made a member of that?
I think Elizabeth saw that I was made a member when we came back for a trip one summer. I think it was probably around 19...
I don't remember, frankly. It would have probably been around 1939 or something like that.
Well, when did they, how often did they meet? And
I think once a month. I think they still do. I don't go.
But
I still get the notices.
But you were going then.
Yes, their meetings were interesting.
You did enjoy that.
Yes, because it has a cross-section of astronomy and geology and chemistry, medicine, that sort of thing. Yes, I enjoyed it. That's the kind of thing. I mean, that's what I would rather enjoy.
Did you give papers yourself?
I may have given. Yes, I think I gave one. Short, very informal things. Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Were there other social interests that you had with your husband? Music, drama? What did you do in theater? Were you part of a little theater group?
No, we just went to theater.
You went to theater here in Madison?
Yes, and still do. Mm-hmm. I still do. I think Madison has a lot of talent. I think it's getting better. I think the theater groups are great.
Mm.
That the Savoyards are
yes, they're wonderful.
Wonderful, indeed. And let's see. And I think that now that we've got theaters to go to, the Mitchell Theater and the downtown theaters, before it used to be all these experimental, awful things that they put on at the Union. Remember? Do you?
They were awful.
They
I remember
were.
Going to
they
some
were
student
just
groups,
awful,
and then
yes.
I know, but now I go to the student plays at Vilas, and I enjoy
Aren't
most
they
of
good?
Them very much.
Indeed. Mm.
So it's gradually sort of changed, and then it went through. The university went through another change after the war. Were you part of that? Where how did it affect
you
mean when
this?
When all of a sudden all of those GIs hit and things began to expand.
And those awful revolutionists, you know, this is that era. You know, when the street people got out and were militant.
Well,
You're
ahead of me. I'm thinking in terms of you were here during the war and things were expanding and the temporary huts appeared, but then all of a sudden there were all of these students in the university went from 8,000 to how many thousand?
40. Too many. It just, you know, it's overwhelming.
And during that period, it was it a gradual growth? How did the expansion of your department affect you?
Well, for one thing, I think that thing wasn't gradual. I think it mushroomed.
I think it was
just an explosion.
There was the veterans came back and it did it.
Had there been a baby explosion too?
Well, that came later.
The veterans had all those babies. But how did that invasion of the veterans affect your department and what you were doing? Was there greater pressure for your husband to teach because there were more students than there were teachers?
I think it was hard on the teachers, yes. I think it was, because I think a lot of these people... See, I don't know if I'm thinking this through right. It seemed to me that that was the beginning of his discontent, his disenchantment with teaching, that a lot of these people were going who would never have gone before, who didn't particularly want these subjects. I mean, it was a case of, was it a do or die proposition?
Think about this carefully, because what I have heard so many times is how very invigorating the period of the veterans was. They were so eager to get back to school, and they worked so hard. And many people have said they made wonderful students because of that. They were more mature. They were really interested. I wonder if you'd be thinking of a period somewhat later.
Later.
Could
I think
that
I
be?
Am.
Because
yes.
this will be around the 49 and 50.
Yeah, I'm really not.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right, because that was a period. He got a lot of Canadian students then. He was very pleased with them. They were a little more mature, I think. He was getting a little older group of people in. And liked that. He thought that was great. I'm afraid I've missed out on something here.
Well, you speak of, you said that he became disenchanted.
Later on, yes. I think it must not have been that first group. Because we came back, you see, about the time they were coming back. Because then the war was over. And then later on, these smart alecks came in. The kids who weren't going to hand in a notebook, and they didn't. No, they were.
Was this undergraduates or graduate students? Undergraduate students?
I think they'd have to be undergraduates, yes.
And so this Although would have had, been probably in the 50s, the early 50s?
Yes, it
50s?
Would have to be in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, his own personal direction was always to graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
These were always masters and so forth. I think he only taught one undergraduate course. But, you know, I'm thinking of one or two instances in which he would make a floor plan for the seating and then just have some people just sit. You think I'm going to sit in that seat? You're crazy. I'll sit wherever I want. there were some really independent thinkers, to put it mildly. Some people who would do anything not to conform.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the sake of being different.
Well, this sounds like the 60s.
Yeah, all right.
When did he die?
He died in 76.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. So, and was teaching, when did he retire?
Yeah, he'd only been retired 2 years.
I see. So he was teaching on in 1974 then?
Yes.
Yes, so it's the 60s that you're talking about.
I was getting mixed mm-hmm. up with the 50s, yes.
All during this period, were you still working with him in the laboratory?
Yeah. Yes, because we published quite extensively, at least one paper a year. And in fact, our last paper was published the year that he died. He didn't get to see it.
During that period, you said when you came back here, finally, that there was this sense that people were not really interested in your field. The students didn't seem to have the interest in it. More interested in other more romance than
highfalutin stuff. You know, it's like the...
There are fashions in research, as there are fashions in everything else, and this was not the fashion. Did you see this shift and change again?
Yes.
And when did this take place?
That is a very interesting thing, and I'm terribly sorry that he didn't live to see it, because this was the one thing that hurt him, was that, you know, it had become old-fashioned and out of style. Boy, is it in style now. This came back when... we began running out of fertilizer, and when we began seeing the need to preserve the land and see the need to... It's a conservancy era. It's very much in vogue now.
When did this come back? After your husband had died, or was it...
really, with a bang.
So there was really, up until that time, they were still talking about the chemical treatments and so forth, and they weren't...
It wasn't until chemistry became chemical treatment became a dirty word, and
sort of the silent spring kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. Now, this would be around 60, going into 65, 67. No, no. Be 70.
Mm-hmm.
1970, yeah.
And, but all the way from the late 40s.
Yes.
Until 1970, this was a field that was interesting to you and interesting to some students. But
I would say it was still in vogue in the 40s. When did I graduate? Yeah, it was still in vogue up to about 40, 45. But between 45 and 65, close to 70, it was very outmoded. It's like space work. It's like the space age, where aeroplanes then were superseded by jets.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Well, it Dorothy's right. I mean, this happens in all the disciplines, that one field of study suddenly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the question of fashion. Sure. Although this isn't really fashion. This is a change in outlook on the world. You actually finished a book that you'd start. I mean, it isn't just an article. Didn't you finish
up? Would you like to see it?
Yes.
When you started it, it was your idea, pretty much. It was because of the botanical interest that I had in this great wealth of legumes in Hawaii. And I felt that since nobody had ever worked on them before, that we ought to find out whether this symbiosis took place under tropical conditions as well as under temperate conditions, because nobody really had done that. And so we methodically started out. And because he had an association with the pineapple plantation plots and their vast holdings of land, and also had them with the sugar station, we had access to their areas, you see. And the sugar station had pioneered in the introduction of exotic plants from all over the world, Philippines, South Sea Islands, Australia, and so forth, and had imported them. And they had arborita. They had some lovely arborita in various areas in the island in which they had plants and had very carefully labeled everything. So it was very easy. It was just a made-to-order situation where we could go and we'd have labels on the plants. And we had botanists who would accompany us and verify that these were the right plants to work with. I couldn't have found this anywhere. It was just absolutely perfectly made to order. So then we began methodically, and this is where we'd take field trips. This would be the way we'd spend weekends. We'd go out to these lovely mountain areas and dig and collect. We would collect these root nodules, and then we would go to the lab, and then we would slice them, and we would take the art. They're full of millions of bacteria. And then take them, culture them, purify them. And then we would go to the greenhouses and we'd make experiments with them, you see, to make sure that that the organism we isolated would again produce these nodules, as they're called. And we did that from the year we arrived when did we go out there? 1930 to 1945, 15 years. So it's a 15-year study. Then when we went to Europe, we did the same thing in the in Kew Gardens in England. We were in England for almost a year, and we had access. We'd go into London and do this. We did it in Germany and so forth. And then when we traveled, we went to the Philippines and Tokyo around. We did the same thing there.
And when did you start writing the book?
That was a whole bunch of notes and cards and organisms that we collected. And we didn't start it until he retired.
Mm-hmm.
And then we gathered all these notes together and we started. And we figured the best way to do would be A to Z. And so we've arranged it alphabetically according to the plants, not the name of the plants, but the name of the genera that the plants belonged in, and the genera then are arranged according to subfamilies. See, so that's it was organized.
Did you ever disagree about anything?
Sure, of course we did. I think it'd be better to do it this way. No, I think you're wrong. I think you'd better do it that way. But this thing had only been organized in a typewritten form that needed a lot of correction and reorganization. And I spent nearly 5 years writing it after he died and getting it. Do you know Betty Steinbeck?
I know her. She's a dear friend of mine, and she's
Betty's
a wonderful woman. Yes.
And Betty is really responsible getting this whipped up right.
She's first class.
Well, I'm glad we have that association, yes. Yes. Betty gave me a lot of leeway, and Betty was... My, she's bright.
Yes.
she caught on. You know, she didn't know beans about this. She knows as much as I do about it now.
I can believe that. And a 100 other subjects as well, because yes, she does the same thing with other authors. Yes, she's remarkable. So you put your husband's name first because...
Oh, well, sure. That's the way to do it, wouldn't you?
Well, I suppose if he would... Yes, I suppose so.
Well, I...
Yes, obviously.
No, I this is more than 50% of my book. It has to be.
But it's in memory of him in a way.
Yeah,
so,
sure. But
yes.
You see, we started out together, so why not end together? The idea that I had that was completely my own idea was that we had to break down all these names from the Greek, and we had to. So I spent years, as it were, trying to find out why it was named that way. And I'm responsible for all the tabulation in the back, and most of the, there are over 1,000 references. Yeah. It's a good job. But it... They bound it so beautifully. Look, it just...
Yeah.
I'm real pleased with it. And Betty,
are you writing anything now?
No. Through.
This was the end.
This is the end. This is the end. It's... There is no more.
You got an honorary degree.
Yeah. Thanks to somebody. I don't know.
That pleased you very much.
Well, I'm sorry that it didn't come while he was alive. I mean, I think maybe it should have been a shared degree. But I was pleased, because I don't have a doctor's degree otherwise. And as I told Betty, I've never wanted one. I don't think you have to have degrees. Some of the smartest people I know didn't have degrees. The head of our department, Hastings, when I was going to school, didn't have a degree. And he outshone anybody in that department with degrees. That's my feeling on the subject.
Do you think it would be possible for someone today to without a degree, to do the extensive research that you did?
Well, I was very lucky in that I lived in that area. That was the inspiration for it all, or the reason it got a push. The second is that my husband was very well known and was invited to a number of countries. See, I didn't go with him to Brazil, and I didn't go with him to Ethiopia, but we had this wonderful trip in which we started out in the Arctic, in Alaska, and made collections in the Arctic and in Alaska, went to Japan for 3 weeks, and were favored by being taken to forestry areas and collected, and then went to the Philippines for 3 weeks and collected in rice paddies and in mountainous areas. And then went to Australia and Fiji and New Zealand, back to what? I mean, this was, but without him, I couldn't have done it. I wouldn't have done it.
Yes, I can believe that. Yeah.
And I think without me, he probably wouldn't have persisted in it. Probably wouldn't have done it. And then when we lived in Europe, we had this wonderful association at Kew Gardens, and they permitted us to uproot anything that we wanted, which is, you know, this is essentially how we got a lot of the species that are very rare, because they have this great collection from Africa and from Asia, from all over the world. And we were privileged to, nobody had done it. Was it, you know, curiosity?
And when you were moving around as you did with him, and what was your acceptance by the other scientists in the other countries?
Completely.
As a team?
Yeah, completely. Sure. There was no discrimination at all.
Was there more of a feeling in some of these countries that you were acceptable as part of a team than there might be in others? Or was...
In Asia, I think it's considered, they're very curious about it, because women don't team up that way.
I think that's what I was...
Yes, I think so. And I think they were very perplexed that we didn't have a family. Yeah, that something was greatly missing there, you see, that this was a strange situation. But I think otherwise, it was accepted. I think in Germany it was, I don't know, some man in Holland said, you know, this would never work in Holland. Oh, I didn't know what he meant, but
that'd be nice to know, wouldn't it?
It would now. Well, there was never a sense of your feeling that you were sort of immersed in him, and that,
no,
that there was never this sense of need to find your own identity.
Never.
That
never
seems to
Ruth,
be so
Ruth
difficult.
Dickey does not understand this. She insists that I must at some time felt discriminated against, and she persists in thinking, and I'm not that kind of a feminist, I'm afraid. I've never experienced discrimination. Why is this? That was I insensitive to it? That there was there, and I just...
Well, you know how what women are saying about the woman's world,
yes,
at work,
yes,
and how they're underpaid.
Yes,
and
I don't understand it.
And, well, you know that was a fact for many women, Ruth,
yes,
Glassow or Helen White.
You, of course.
And do you mind on their behalves, or do you think that they complained unnecessarily? Not that they actually did complain, but later people did. I mean, what do you feel that? What's your view of the new women's outlook on women in the working world and their disturbance about not being sufficiently well paid or honored?
Gosh, that's hard to answer. I've always felt that, maybe I shouldn't use names here, but I felt that with Ruth Dickey, for instance, that she had never experienced a rich association with a man, and that was probably part of her lack of understanding. Isn't that an awful thing to say? But I can't answer that. I sometimes feel that they are making more of it than need be made of it. That they're reading something into it that isn't there, and yet I know that isn't right, because there must be a vast batch of evidence where they have been discriminated against, where men have gotten much higher salaries, and men have loaded them up with their work and then taken the credit for it, this sort of thing.
Yeah, and this, what you had then basically was a sense of real partnership.
Exactly.
You didn't really feel as if you weren't part of this team, just because you weren't paid for it. Your sense of personal
reward from the
work that you did was you had a great sense of
that.
Yes. Did you ever have a situation where if you were discussing your work and your research with people not other than your husband, that they took what you had to say very seriously? Did they really give you credit, or did they sometimes?
I think I see what you're trying to say, and I don't think I ever came across that.
One of the things that women have been saying recently is that there is a sense that when they are in a one-to-one situation and people ask for their suggestions and so forth, that if they're in a group that is both male and female, that the women will put forward ideas and suggestions, and they're really not taken seriously. That 24 hours later, the same group will meet, and having rejected those ideas when they were put forward by the women, if they're put forward by a man, then they take them seriously.
I'm
driving at. Did you ever have this sense that...
I don't think I was ever in that experience. No.
You've never had that happen to you. That may explain why you have this real sense of partnership.
Did you, Elizabeth McCoy would be, and I don't know enough about her, but do you feel that she was rewarded adequately for her merit?
Sure, she was. I think that Yeah, I do. I really do. She was rewarded adequately. She was acknowledged. She was duly honored.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen E.B. Fred's interview, and he speaks, he, I think, might be called a rather a sexist. he speaks rather disparagingly, yeah. And he speaks of women and their beautiful legs and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was... a dirty old man.
Yes, that's right. But when it came to a colleague, there was nothing. He was completely, and he completely respected her.
Yeah.
And you also.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Well, that's perfectly possible.
Yeah, I think so. I think that as I said in the beginning, she was his right-hand man. I think you could not have begun to accomplish what he did when she and he were working directly. If she hadn't been the one who did... she was a scullery maid. She did dirty work.
Now you're that's what we were just.
Yes,
that's what I'm wondering.
Yes, she was. She really and truly. But she got credit for it. It wasn't as though in the end, her name was left out.
Hmm.
See what I mean?
Yes, but still, one would like to have one's name there, and also not perhaps have to do the dirty work.
Well, that's right. That's right. But he was so busy, and she was so honored. Elizabeth was, in some ways, Elizabeth was a little, it went to her head, and she just adored him. She would do anything for Dr. Fred.
Oh.
So it was nothing that she would turn around and say, well, Larry made me do it again. You know?
Yeah.
She loved doing it.
That was a familiar feeling, mm-hmm. I think.
Did you ever have a sense, you were in the School of Agriculture,
yes.
Where they're generally... There seems to be an interesting...
Cow College, yes.
Yeah, the Cow College. But was there as much encouragement there for the girls to go into the sciences?
Homec.
Or primarily. So you were unusual in that you were...
But I was not in the Ag College till I got my fellowship. See, I was in Letters and Science. And I must admit, we looked down on the Ag College. It's just a bunch of country bumpkins. The men had the manure on their heels. Mm. This really, I was an absolute snob about that when I was an undergraduate.
But then you were offered this fellowship. Yeah. Dr. Fred arranged it.
Was it a war fellowship, by the way?
No, it wasn't. It was...
Well, there is a name there, Frash.
Frash.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, Frash was a multimillionaire as a result of his inventing a process for cracking by electricity nitrogen out of the air and turning it into nitrate fertilizer. It's almost like Nobel having invented whatever he invented, dynamite.
Yes.
Dynamite. And so his widow, Mrs. Frash, was very generous on donating to research that had anything to do with nitrogen fixation. Mm. Because this was a biological process as opposed to a chemical process. His was an electrical-chemical process. See, and this is biological. And the University of Wisconsin was given a tremendous sum of money. I think they were given $10,000, something like that. Oh, it was the biggest thing. You know, it made headlines. This was this vast award that was given. You know, it'd be peanuts nowadays. And outside of that, well, then Fred got it, and then Fred awarded this. It was called a Frash Laboratory, and there were three of us in it to begin with. And I'm the only one left who's living. Perry Wilson died. Hopkins died. And it isn't in existence anymore.
And this was a fellowship as a graduate student. You were working on a master's degree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a nitrogen fixation. And that's how this university got its toe in nitrogen fixation. And it all revolved around Dr. Fred from the bacteriological end and Professor Peterson in chemistry. And then this nubbin of students, you see. And then this has continued. So right now, there's nobody in it. Now, Dr. Burris, do you know him?
I've heard his name. Yes,
well, Dr. Burris is in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's... splendid work. He's world-renowned. He's over in biochemistry department.
Well, there's sort of a camaraderie among the students in that particular field that was unusual for that time?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. There was when we went to meetings. If we went to national meetings, then there would be a section on nitrogen fixation. Mm-hmm. And then we would have lunches together and argue and this sort of thing.
And always during this period, you were always a part of it. And,
oh, yeah,
and,
sure.
And a partner to always, it. And
the thing is, I've always worked very comfortably with men. Mm-hmm. And I might be the only woman at a luncheon table or something like that. But this, there was nothing sexist about it. It was just, this thing was
I just realized we've made a big mistake in interviewing you because you're clearly not a faculty wife.
We'll tear it up.
I think it's an interesting role of a faculty wife that is very rare.
It's very unusual.
It's extremely unusual.
Is it really?
Of course, the Millers are an example.
Oh, yes,
of
yes.
But we were thinking of faculty wives who were left at home, sitting, tending the babies, and the house, and making everything quiet. And never had to cope
never
with that.
Never had to cope with that. That was completely out of the
picture.
And
there never seemed to be a sense from those traditional faculty wives, did they ever seem to appear to resent what you did?
I don't think so. I don't. The women in the department, I'm sincere on this, and I want to emphasize it, they thought I helped my husband.
Yeah.
I don't know what they thought I did. I think maybe I washed dishes in the lab. Or,
they
you
know,
did.
Did
you
they,
mind that?
No, I didn't. I just,
you
why bother to explain? Sure.
It's sort of, you found that amusing.
I disregarded it. You know, I considered the sources.
You certainly would have 30 years or 20 years later gone ahead and gotten a PhD, wouldn't you?
I never cared about it.
But I mean, if
I suppose
time,
so. If I could have made it. This is, you know, there's a lot goes into that doesn't meet the eye. I as regards publication, I've already considered that I did what I would have to have done for a PhD and more.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to handling the computer science that they would require now and the arithmetic and the chemistry and all that, I don't know if I'd had the gumption to. I like to do what I like to do. Would you like to have some coffee or some tea?